like to bring to order the House Committee on Consumer Protection Government Efficiency. Committee, our schedule's a little bit shorter today. We're going to start in a different order than what's on the agenda for those of you that are in the audience, because normally I start at the top and just go straight through. But today, we're going to start with House Bill 2931, and then we will go to House Bill 2527 and then 2856, and we'll end with our work session. Although, given that some members may be leaving early, I may move that work session in the middle somewhere. So we'll have to wait and see how that transpires. So with that, I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2931. And Bob, would you give us a little information about this bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2931 creates a deferred maintenance elimination fund and authorizes the state treasurer to issue bonds or certificates of participation to fund state facility maintenance. The bill requires the Department of Administrative Services and Capital Projects Advisory Board to determine the condition of state facilities and extent of deferred maintenance needed for each facility. It requires DAS to submit a plan to the Legislative Assembly for creation of a deferred maintenance database. It requires DAS and CPAB to prioritize deferred maintenance needs of state facilities and make recommendations to the governor for expenditures from that deferred maintenance elimination fund, and requires agencies that own state facilities to assess the condition, report to DAS, and cooperate with DAS in tracking condition and maintenance performed. Finally, the bill requires a biennial report from DAS on deferred maintenance of state facilities. The measure declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
Thank you, Bob. And committee members, I don't believe any of you are on the committee last session. Our committee did look at deferred maintenance issues a couple of times last session and were unable to come up with a real good pathway to address deferred maintenance. We did feel this was something of importance the state needed to address and was pre-session filed with my former co-chair, Gene Wisnett, and I decided to make this a committee bill and really work on a deferred maintenance bill that maybe would help us address some of those needs in the state, and that's the bill we have before us. And with that, I would like to have George Naughton from DAS come up and sort of walk us through whatever parts of the bill he'd like and tell us a little bit about deferred maintenance and the plan from DAS and whether or not this bill is in step with that agenda.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, I'm George Naughton. I'm the Chief Financial Officer of the State of Oregon. Ken Rocco's counterpart on the executive branch side. I work for Michael Jordan, and as Representative Smith has seen, inside the Department of Administrative Services, we've really split what we do into two major areas. The one is that we decided that we needed to separate the service side of what DAS does from the policy-making side, because we found that we haven't done always the best job of really trying to figure out that long-term strategy from a policy perspective. Deferred maintenance is a very large issue in state government. In 2012, state agencies reported over $200 million of deferred maintenance on the buildings that we own, and primarily because we can issue the resources to actually build the buildings, but have not done a good job of maintaining those buildings over time, which is why, for example, we have a state hospital that we're in the process of replacing right now. The Department of Administrative Services has undergone a 10-year vision strategy to look on the future, really what are the kinds of issues that we want to address, and House Bill 2931 fits right in with that. The state of Oregon does have a pretty good planning process for facility planning that the legislature established in 1997. It lays out a good process that uses this thing that's called the Capital Planning Advisory Board, which is called CPAB. It's experts in the area who really run our new buildings through to get an idea of, does this make sense? Are these the right types of things that we want to accomplish? But what we haven't done very well, and the things that we need to improve on, really fall into two major categories. The first one is data on deferred maintenance and life cycle of buildings and when do we need to upgrade our maintenance projects. And the other one, quite frankly, is a dedicated funding source. As you see in your Ways and Means Committees, there's a lot of pressure on the competing demands of providing services to the citizens, and sometimes over time the maintenance of our infrastructure falls behind. So the second area that 2931, both of these areas, both on the information side and then also on the dedicated funding side, this bill works, and we actually support the bill in the way it's currently structured. The governor's budget actually also supports House Bill 2931, and really does two things. The first one is that we do not currently have a system-wide data system to maintain support, and as Representative Greg Smith has seen inside of our Ways and Means Committee, we have a package that basically adds two staff to develop a long-range facility plan and about $3.3 million to actually provide staff and a data system that will allow us to do long-term life cycle replacement of our facilities. The second thing that the governor's budget does, which is also encapsulated in House Bill 2931, is it authorizes about $53 million of debt financing that we would expect, if House Bill 2931 passes, would be placed into this deferred maintenance fund that's created in this bill, which we would then be able to start whittling down on those deferred maintenance issues. Best practice is you deal with maintenance on an ongoing basis, and you just budget in the cost of maintaining those facilities. We are behind those times, and that's why we're looking at the deferred maintenance issue that we need to catch up on. The last thing for my remarks is really that state agencies have the same desire you do to be good stewards of the resources we have. And I think that the ability that this bill has done that allows DAS and CPAP to work with the executive branch agencies will allow us to really address this issue over the long term. This is not a short-term issue. I'll be very clear about that. These deferred maintenance is not something we're take care of in one biennium. So this will be an ongoing relationship that we have with the legislature and the Ways and Means process to really address these issues and get these facilities where we want them to be on the long term. So, Mr. Chair, with that, I can stand down and answer questions, but bottom line is we do support the bill. It is supported by the governor's budget, and we'll have those conversations in the Ways and Means Committee. And I will stop my prepared testimony.
Great. Thank you for that clear overview that probably none of us could have delivered. Questions? Representative Richardson.
I have a few. May I?
Sure.
Thank you. Was it two sessions ago that we had the discussion that we really shouldn't be using certificates of participation for items that normally should be bonded, mm-hmm. let alone items that normally would be included in a budget like maintenance? And now here we are after the first session where we had 11 Q bonds, which got us out of the COP business, and now there's a bill that we should reestablish or start using certificates of deposit again. Would you explain what happened to cause this change in position?
So, Chair Holvey, Representative Richardson, 11 Q bonds, I'm using the debt phrase generically to not get into all the nuances of it. Generally speaking, we are moving all to 11 Q bonds as the actual mechanism to do financing as opposed to certificates of participation, primarily because we get a better deal on them. We actually get a better interest rate. The real question, though, about why are we debt financing the deferred maintenance costs as opposed to building it in, my answer, quite frankly, is that we are so far behind on this that it is part of catching up. I think we are trying to build in the ongoing maintenance costs of maintaining the buildings at where they're at. But quite frankly, $200 million of investing back in, if we had the resources, it would be a different way to actually pay for them with straight general fund. And I have, quite frankly, several debates with my bonding folks about when you're talking about maintaining an asset that has a useful life of 20 to 30 years, let's take a roof, for example, they would argue back to me that using debt financing to spread the cost of that roof replacement, for example, over the life of that roof actually makes sense so that you can actually spread those costs out. That's a philosophical debate, quite frankly, and I lean toward the more conservative side. My bonding people will argue the counter side. So there are both ways to do it, both of them legitimate. We're certainly not trying to debt finance anything beyond the life of what the useful assets are that we're building.
Okay, just to kind of continue then. Why utilize COPs instead of utilizing the 5% acceptable limitation that we've placed over debt? I mean, if this to me looks like this is kind of off-budget debt, the governor's come forward and said we need to make additional bonding, and there's others in this building who have power who say we should borrow to the limit, and yet this is not within that limit. Why wouldn't this be part of the bonding package?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, I'll have to go back and check on specifically how the bond capacity is calculated. This first initial push of stuff in is for DAS-owned buildings, which are primarily funded with assessment dollars, which do impact general fund agencies down the road. So I will have to go back and look, and we can get the information to you if we've counted any of these toward the debt capacity or not. Bottom line is the governor's budget didn't propose spending all the debt capacity. In fact, it left $300+ million unspent, specifically so we wouldn't be coming close to that target. So I can look specifically to see how much of this counted toward debt capacity or not. That I don't have the answer to right now.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair, the whole concept of certificates of participation as a separate means of bonding harkens back to a time when I believe Portland wanted to buy parking meters, but they couldn't afford to do that, and so the idea was, why don't we have a create a debt capacity where you'll borrow the money and you'll pay back the debt from the thing that you're doing. And so if you're going to buy parking meters, then you can pay the debt with the proceeds from the parking meters. And what is being proposed here is a major break from the concept of certificates of participation, and is also not included in normal bonding. And so I think we ought to seriously look at why should we use something that was never designed for deferred maintenance as a vehicle to borrow between $50 and $200 million to do maintenance on buildings when normally maintenance would be included in your budgets, and merely say we haven't included it in the past and therefore let's just do it and then charge others in the future. You know, future legislators cannot use the proceeds of the money that's going to pay for this debt for education and other things, because they'll be strapped with additional debt servicing requirements for 20 or 30 years.
Certainly, and I appreciate that look at the budgetary, I suppose, ramifications of how this gets done, and certainly won't, you know, express that I'm totally on board with one way of funding versus another. That is why this bill has a subsequent ways and means to parse out whether this actual mechanism is the correct one. The purpose in this policy committee, though, is to really establish the policy of an attempt at trying to address deferred maintenance in this state, because as Mr. Naughton has pointed out, it is something that the state has fallen very far behind on, and that was part of our presentation last session of how far we actually were behind, and actually the ramifications of the asset value that the state is losing by not addressing this deferred maintenance is really quite alarming, and something that I think the state needs to take very seriously and figure out a way to get there. I think this bill is an attempt at finding a pathway to get there. The Ways and Means process will, I'm sure, take a very close look at the funding mechanism and its budgetary consequences of which pathway it would be best. Whether they agree with this particular pathway, I'm not going to second guess.
For clarification, Mr. Chair, you're saying then that the vehicle that would be used is not a policy issue that we would address, merely that if we want to go forward or not, because I was thinking that Ways and Means would probably be dealing with the money aspect but not the policy as to whether it was the appropriate use or not to use COPs as compared to bonding, Q bonds or otherwise.
Well, that would be something that Ways and Means will definitely weigh in on, I believe. And so the policy of actually which I think funding mechanism they use to get what's contained in the policy. There's other policies contained in this bill that would need to be addressed too. But I'll let Mr. Naughton speak to your question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, House Bill 2931 does not mention at all what the funding source is as far as which type of debt financing instrument. All it does is creates the fund that you would then put bond proceeds or other resources into. It could be a direct appropriation if that's what Ways and Means decided to do down the road. This bill simply creates the mechanism, a vehicle to put the money into that then can be drawn down to actually make the deferred maintenance payments.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Lively.
Before I ask my question, I've been involved at the local level with these same kind of issues with public buildings, and unfortunately, much of that's being paid for by my bonds because we have to catch up and keep the life cycle of the buildings. But so my question has to do with when we're defining concerns about deferred maintenance and defining what we will spend to continue the life of the building, that the issue about when we make the choice to invest. So if we're investing, so we're like on a roof that may last 20 years, mm-hmm. but the building, life is near, maybe we expect 10 years left in the building. Mm-hmm. So there's this offset in cost, and I need to understand a bit more when we're talking about deferred maintenance. So how do we draw those lines, or where do we draw those lines?
So Chair Holvey, Representative Lively, the bill actually talks about the Department of Administrative Services working with the Capital Planning Advisory Board to develop exactly the kinds of criteria that you're talking about. And it actually talks about not just deferred maintenance, but also coming up with a strategy about preventative maintenance so that we don't tip into that. Sure. And we recognize that part of the reason we're in this problem is that we didn't do the preventative maintenance on the front side, and then we got into that situation. So the bill really gives authority and responsibility to Department of Administrative Services and CPAB to really develop that kind of strategy, which is, Representative Smith stepped out of the room, but that's exactly the direction that we're trying to head.
Great. Thank you.
Now, I will also say, I need to say that this is going to take time to develop this, so we're not going to fix it in just 2 years.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Naughton, I appreciate your drawing out the clarification about preventative maintenance. Mm-hmm. As a taxpayer and as someone who also has experience at the local level with school district maintenance and buildings and so forth, you know, it's a frustrating thing for some public entities to shirk their responsibilities, if you will, on making sure that preventative maintenance is a part of their ongoing cost of doing business. Mm-hmm. Because when that doesn't happen, you're confronted with what Portland Public School had to do this last year. It's come up with $500 million of bonding to just to come up, you know, primarily just for maintenance for buildings that have been ignored for far too long. Mm-hmm. I'm hopeful that what you're proposing here will in essence kind of drive a stake in the ground regarding the state of Oregon, saying from here on we will have a plan for preventative maintenance for all new buildings that will be constructed as well as those buildings currently in existence, because I just don't think it's right to keep coming back for the taxpayers asking for more money, more bond and indebtedness and so forth, just to fund those things that should become a part of the cost of doing business. You know, if we don't have the resources available to pay for maintenance of buildings, we certainly shouldn't have the resources available to construct new buildings mm-hmm. to replace them with. So.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I think that that is absolutely what we're trying to get our arms around. What I will tell you, and just to caveat it, some of these buildings we're talking about are 50, 60-year-old buildings. Mm-hmm. So they're way beyond the useful life of, say, 30, for example. And every one of these buildings is different. We have some of our buildings, if you look at the state hospital, the old state hospital, these things are constructed a long, long time ago. And quite frankly, best practice maybe to tear them down and do something new. But until we get that kind of authority to make those kind of investments, that's a big invest. So you try and patch some of these together. But we're absolutely trying to move that direction so that we're forward planning as opposed to trying to kick in on the stuff on the backside. Unfortunately, we're in a spot where we have to do both. We have to preventatively plan for the future at the same time trying to shore up this deferred maintenance backlog that we've got in the past. So we are trying to do both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. I think that is one of the main purposes of this bill, is to get that maintenance and that preventative maintenance dealt with on an ongoing basis, and I think that's the goal of establishing this fund and moving forward with it. Representative Kinnegar, do you have a question?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify that this is only for state buildings, even though we wish counties and school districts would do the same, and cities and courthouses. courthouses.
Chair Holvey, Representative Kinnegar, that's correct. It's just for the state-owned facilities. In fact, the first wave of how we're looking at rolling this out focuses first on the DAS-owned buildings, mm-hmm. which are the primary office space buildings we have. It doesn't go into our correctional institutions yet. We're planning to roll this data system out as we go farther along, but we'll start first with this core office space that we have, which are the more straightforward ones.
And I think that's part of the policy that's contained in this bill, is actually getting that inventory list from across state yes. agencies so that it can be more, strategically prioritized mm-hmm. as to what our status is and what the needs going forward should be based on the recommendations out of CPAB and the, I guess, the planning directors for each agency.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Facility managers.
Can you comment, please, Mr. Chair?
Representative Kindergarten.
Thank you. And I can't miss the opportunity to hope that you also look at assessing and possibly mitigating radon. It's an issue that I've learned more and more about, and especially at the time you're going in to, you know, assess renovating your facilities. It's number two cause of lung cancer behind tobacco.
Chair Hovey, Representative Kindergarten, there we have a multitude of issues in some of our older buildings that we have to be very cognizant of.
Just adding that to it.
Thank you.
Other comments, questions? Thank you. I can tell that there will be a lot of conversation about this bill, and we'll take a look at it and see what the committee thinks of it. But from your perspective, you're not seeing any direct amendments that are needed in this bill at this time?
Mr. Chair, no, we're not looking at any amendments right now. I think there are open questions about how broad do you look at this, whether or not you want OUS to be part of this conversation, which they have their own system. Parks has a very robust system on their side. So what you choose to do, which agencies apply, is really up to you. The general philosophy here, I think we absolutely support. The governor's budget supports as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Not seeing anyone else signed up. Thank you very much, Mr. Naughton. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2931. And let's see if I can keep to... Representative Smith, what time are you leaving?
I have to leave at 2 o'clock.
Okay. Why don't we go ahead and open a work session and get our work session bill out of the way then. I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 2528. Bob, give us a little refresher on what this bill is that we're considering today.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2528 eliminates the $100,000 cap on value of real estate loan agreements that are subject to certain existing requirements regarding lenders' security protection provision. The bill also makes technical language changes. There's no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact to the bill.
Thank you. Representative Lively.
Chair Hovey, I move House Bill 2528 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Lively moves House Bill 2528 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on this from the committee? Not seeing any. I understand most folks are comfortable with this bill, so... Representative Lively's move House Bill 2528 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Samantha, can we have a vote?
Representative Vega Peterson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Kinney-Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lively?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Oh, aye. Does the representative. House Bill 2528, having received the required votes, is passed to the floor. Committee, I would consider putting this on the consent calendar. Does anybody have an objection to putting this one on the consent calendar? Not seeing any. As much as I'd like to talk about it, we'll put this on the consent calendar. So with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2528. And next on the agenda, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2527. Bob, give us a little information on House Bill 2527.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2527 expands the requirement for disclosure of property or other value included in consideration for conveyance of fee title. Requires true and actual consideration stated on the face of an instrument or memorandum of conveyance to include value and description of other property or value given or promised.
Thank you. And committee members, I did get contacted by the proponents of this bill who weren't able to make it today. They did ask me to introduce this bill. It was another issue around appraisers, which, you know, seemed to be a good topic for today. And it had to do with the Dodd-Frank Act from their recollection that is requiring them to disclose concessions on real properties when they use those properties as comparables in creating a market value in their appraisal process. And knowing that the bill needs amendments, they recognize that, and the chair does as well. There's some great concern about recording these concessions in the title documents. So with that, there doesn't seem to be any proponents of the bill here present, so we're going to bring up two others to speak mildly about the bill. Sean Jillians from the Association of Realtors and Jessica Adamson representing the Oregon Land Title Association. Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Sean Jillians, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. I think other is the kindest thing you've ever called me, Mr. Chair, so appreciate that. We do have concerns with the bill, and I think you addressed them in your discussion of what the bill does. Obviously, the issue of seller concessions, our members have privacy concerns as far as what's going to be included in the public record the way the bill is currently drafted. There would be a number of items that would have to be included in the public record, and there's privacy concerns for two individuals who are involved in a private contract. Along those same lines, it would be very difficult to come up with a determination of actual value when you're throwing in a used dishwasher, a dryer, any other sort of thing that typically is involved in a real estate transaction. Perhaps the most troubling language to us relates, and I'm guessing my colleague's going to touch on it too, with the actual recording process that this would trigger, and the fact that the bill specifically says a county clerk will not accept for recording a conveyance of fee title without this document with concessions. I'm sure you all know that the real estate industry is struggling to recover at this point. Delays are extremely costly in transactions. This certainly will cause additional delay at the county clerk level. For those reasons, Mr. Chair, we do have significant concerns. Look forward to working with you on this issue further. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Go ahead, Ms.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson here today on behalf of the Oregon Land Title Association, and we share the concerns of Mr. Jillians and his association on this bill. Our members are the ones that work with the seller and with the buyer to do the actual paperwork behind these transactions. Our concern is that the bill as written really changes a process that's working today and really raises a bunch of unanswered questions because there are a variety of back and forth that happen at closing and in the process of making a sale go. There's, on the one hand, real concessions paying a portion of the buyer's closing costs. Then there's the kind of convenience to the seller that is not taking the draperies that they just assume leave there or the old dishwasher out. Whether that actually changes the real value of the property, whether that's an actual concession, those I think are hard things to answer. We're very concerned that as the bill is written, you could end up with real inconsistencies with how title companies and how the deeds look. What one company may write down as a concession, another may not. There's a lack of clarity in this bill, and we don't want to kind of go on and on. We had a great conversation with you, Mr. Chair, about our willingness to sit down and be a part of a conversation on this bill. We think this bill needs some work before it would be ready, and we just have some real concerns about making changes to a process that's currently working, and would be happy to work with the appraisers to try and identify what their concerns are and how they relate and are resolved in this bill. We're concerned that this will not serve the interests of sellers and buyers in this market this time.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Questions? Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, when I started practicing law, we used to put down $10 and other valuable consideration, and that was fine. That was consideration. After that changed to what we've had for the last 20 or 30 years, it's worked really well. And so I can't figure out why we're looking for a solution when I can't find the problem. And there's so I think that we really ought not to jump into changing things that could put more subjective pressure on clerks to determine whether something's adequate or not, or on people trying to figure out what prices to put as far as consideration, unless there is a real need for a change of the system that everybody's used to in both legal as well as real estate.
Right. Thank you. And I appreciate that, and I don't disagree with that. And I'm hoping to have a small conversation with the proponents of the bill and the Appraisal Licensure Board, because they've got some mandates that evidently they're working under from Dodd-Frank, which has caused this concern with them. And so I want to be able to sit down and have that conversation, and whether or not we can agree to any kind of solution that helps them. The bill may come back with amendments, or if we can't, it may not. But I'd welcome your input into that discussion. So, and I appreciate your willingness to sit down with the appraisers and see if there's some way that we can figure out whether their concerns are real first, and second, whether there's a way to address those, short of putting this information into the required to be recorded in the title. I see some great trouble with that as well. So thank you very much. Any other comments, questions on this one? Thanks for sharing. And we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2527. And that leaves us left with opening a public hearing on House Bill 2856. Bob, can you give us a description of House Bill 2856?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2856 provides an exemption from mortgage loan originator licensing requirements for individual who offers or negotiates terms for up to 3 residential mortgages per year, unless federal law specifically preempts that exemption. The bill is operative 91 days after the effective date, and the bill declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
Thank you. And in committee, if you recall, we just passed a bill out in this committee previously on loan originator licensing, and I can't remember the bill number, but this bill is sort of a follow-up to that to address some concerns of the seller-financed situations. And I'll leave it at that and let other people talk about it. And so I'm going to bring up Sean Jillians again, twice in one day, and Jim Templin. And I will note that also, if the committee wishes, we do have DCBS in the room to answer any specific questions that we may have about this issue as well. So if you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Sean Jillians once again representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. Try to contain your enthusiasm for twice in one day, Mr. Chair. We are in support of this particular piece of legislation. This is an issue that has been ongoing for several years. Mr. Chair, I think you mentioned the legislative history. House Bill 2189 is the bill that this body passed by an overwhelming majority, which licensed loan originators, our association, was supportive of that language. And it was part of the Federal SAFE Act. You guys will see kind of a little bit of the history in my written testimony. I won't repeat all of it. But when we went through and implemented the SAFE Act at the state level through House Bill 2189, The state of Oregon took a rather restrictive view of what seller financing transactions would still be available. Seller financing being residential property where the owner is offering financing to a prospective purchaser to purchase it. In the existing statute, the exemption says you had to have lived in the house, it had to have been your residence. What this bill would do is expand that slightly and say you could do it for property that you own, still as security for the property, the financing is available, but you could do up to 3 in a 12-month period without having to get a loan originator license. And it's important to note that that's all we're talking about here is the loan originator license. We're not talking about any of the other consumer protections that go along with Dodd-Frank or the Truth in Lending Act. And I put in our testimony a nice summary from the National Association of Realtors of what those protections are. It's the back few pages. I wrote the first two, so you could pretty much ignore those. But the last three are actually informational and quality information. They kind of distill down what the federal rules require. So if this bill were to go into effect, we would be talking about a limited number of seller finance transactions where the seller wouldn't have to go get a loan originator license, but they still would have to do a number of things, including making sure that the amortizing or the financing is fully amortizing. They have to make a good faith determination of the buyer's ability to repay, has to be at a fixed rate, or if it's an adjustable rate, it's subject to caps. All of those things will still apply if this bill goes into effect. What we're just saying, again, is that you don't have to go get a loan originator license to do that. Mr. Chair, I know you've been intimately involved in Dodd-Frank and SAFE and everything that we've been dealing with for a number of years. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau at the federal level is finally issuing their rules around this. The most recent two deal with loan originator compensation requirements and qualified mortgages. The qualified mortgage rule was 804 pages long. I won't give all of it to you, but I did give you a nice little snippet in there on page two of my testimony, which talks about CFPB believing that loan originator does not include a seller who does 3 or fewer transactions in a 12-month period. We're not trying to go any further than what CFPB would be comfortable with. We're just trying to mirror the federal guidance that they've issued in this. We have been in discussions with DCBS. We recognize that the bill does need some amendments. First of all, it references HUD right now. It should be CFPB. And we want to tighten the language up a little bit to their liking as well. Certainly, I don't want to speak for them, and I know that they haven't taken an official position on the bill, but we are in discussions with them, Mr. Chair, and we would need an amendment. With that, I'd probably be happy to answer any questions, or I don't know if you want to hear from my colleague here first.
Yeah, I think we'll listen to the rest of the testimony first, and maybe it'll generate some types of questions.
Mr. Chair, committee, I'm Jim Templin. I own Santa M Escrow, which is a escrow collection company for private transactions. And the reason I decided to testify was just in case there were some questions or clarifications about the impact of private financing, because I see probably more of it as a single individual than anyone else in the state of Oregon. But what I'm not opposed to this bill. I'm opposed to the limits of it. I think that it's very difficult I deal with a lot of realtors throughout the state, and they're putting together packages for people to sell. In this economy, a tremendous amount of seller financing is needed to keep the economy moving. They take first, they take seconds. I don't know why a number is important in this issue. I saw it when it came before the CFPB at 3, the National Association I don't think it was a realtor association, but there was a statement put in asking for like 15 as a limiting factor, not 3. We haven't seen the end of that. We're seeing the CFPB making statements about the fact that when it comes to the regulations, it has to be broad, it has to fit into rural, it has to fit into the community. I've been in this business for 40 years. The private individual who lends on property in small towns, small communities, rural Oregon, it's a very good niche in our economy, and a very, very good niche for realtors, etc. And I don't think that the making it say that a seller is the only one that is exempt, I don't think that's right. I think that there's other people out there who lend their money okay, on transactions either as a second or a first to make a sale happen, but they're not the sellers of the transaction. That's all. So I'm also open for questions.
And Mr. Chair, if I could follow up just a little bit. We certainly had a long dialogue at the association level, and there are a number of members who would not like to see or would agree and don't want to see a cap put on it. I think being cautionary in this building is probably the best approach, and I advise them that perhaps a large number wasn't necessarily the best route. The other reason, honestly, I thought being in front of you all, if we mirrored kind of the guidance from the feds, we were in a lot safer position there. And even with that caveat, we put the language in there saying even if they, after the fact, find that it's not valid, then our law would be invalid as well. So we certainly had a robust discussion, and there's a variety of views at the association level. I think we gave you a pretty safe proposal, no pun intended. Rather than going with unlimited.
Questions from the committee? Representative Vega Peterson.
Thank you, Chair. What's entailed in getting a license, for the people? What do they have to do now that they wouldn't have to do with this bill?
Well, ask them. You apply. You have to have a background investigation. You have to have financials. You have to report. I believe if you're going to be a licensed loan originator, there's requirements of reporting on the national level, mm-hmm. reporting on the state level. It opens that individual up to the whole testing and examination and everything. You have to take classes and become tested in all of it. So to me, I'm not negative about it because it's necessary, but to ask an individual who owns a parcel of ground and subdivides it to become single-family residential property and selling 30 lots in a subdivision as best he can to get things so he takes back papers, he's going to have to go through a whole licensing process to do that. So that's part of it. I think it's cumbersome.
And we will bring DCBS up after we're done with this panel. Any other questions for this group? Well, I guess I have a question then. in the bill, can you tell me whether the seller who is financing the property, is the seller required to be the owner of the property?
Mr. Chair, yes. Okay. I think purchase money obligation, seller, that's what we're trying to convey there. DCBS and their representatives and I have talked about additional language to make clear in there, but absolutely, and if you look at the federal documents that I sent you as well, it's very clear you have to be the owner. It's seller financing on right. residential property that you own.
Right. So what would be the difference between an owner, for example, who owns hundreds of properties and a bank who owns 100 properties financing loans for people to buy those properties? I mean, in terms of other than they go over the three, I suppose. But, yeah, I mean, even if you owned hundreds of property, you could still do three a year, and you'd have a pretty good-sized portfolio built up of loans and paper that you have out. And so... So I'm just trying to decide. Is that the right measurement? And what's the difference between an owner who does that as opposed to, say, a broker who owns the same amount that could be doing it?
First of all, Mr. Chair, I'd love to meet the person who has hundreds of properties in this environment that could extend credit on all those properties as well. I think that probably doesn't exist, I think DCBS could answer as well. There's also provisions about if it's routine, part of business sort of thing. This really isn't, we're not talking about a business where folks own hundreds of properties and they're in the routine. We're talking about someone who might do one or two in a given year. It's not something that it's a routine business. When we were approached about this bill, I think it gets back to my previous comments where people said, what about a developer? developer who, well, honestly, a developer should go get a loan originator license, and they do. This really is talking about individual sellers who do maybe a couple a year. I don't think that you're going to see, and in conversations with the department, I know they would view someone who does 3 year every year for indefinitely as being more routine and in the business.
Mr. Chair, right. I do have one question that just occurred to me after you started your thing. Thank you. I'm just thinking about some of the individuals or groups of individuals that might have an overlay of an LLC. You know, they'll put the property in the ownership of the LLC, but it's really owned by the individuals. Would this include those entities and or the people that are a part of those entities?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, great question, and we've had that conversation in a number of working groups. This bill, the way we interpret it, would just be individuals. I know there's been discussion, and there's a broader coalition bill on this topic, too, that will encompass a variety of real estate-related issues. Folks in that group would like to see LLCs be able to do it. To be honest with you, that's not what our bill would do. That's not what we're pushing for. We're really looking out for individuals in this. I think there's a way probably on LLCs that you could get there where you say you can't have an overlapping interest or interest in multiple LLCs to ensure that folks don't do it. That's not what we're going to try and do in this bill, though.
One follow-up, too, on trust. People put their properties in trust for, you know, like revocable and irrevocable trusts. Would it be included?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, I think not under this language, but that certainly is a topic for discussion. As you see, most likely, Mr. Chair, the coalition bill, because I believe it's going to be a House bill, and most likely in your committee as well, where there might be a little broader definition.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I might just add to the conundrum, I think here is the fact that just this week, okay, so I can be, we had a situation where there was a payoff of one of our accounts to an estate, to the family of an estate. These people, each individual person received over $500,000. Okay, three of those people came back in lending their money to neighbors or whatever because they wanted to get it back out so that they could earn a better return than the banks currently pay. Okay, we see where in the course of a year, a person who has a portfolio of mortgages as an investment tool, private investor, and there's a lot of them in Oregon, okay, where they could in fact go over three because they would have money to invest and they would have somebody pay them off right in the middle of all that and then have more money to invest. And that's what it's all about, is an investment tool for the private individual. And not these people don't, you know, they do it as a tool for investment, either with their self-directed IRA or whatever they're doing, but they're setting it up so that it's an investment tool. And you're seeing more and more people in an economy where the banks aren't paying any return, that they seek a second option or a third option to invest their money. And the realtors in any community in Oregon knows who these people are, and they ask them to assist in the transaction to make it go. And it's creative financing at its very best. And to limit those people to what, how many they can do before they get licensed, or what happens if they go to the fourth or the fifth? It's too limiting.
Thank you. I appreciate your comments. And Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Holby. I have to share, I think Representative Thatcher's on the mark with her comment about LLCs. And I'm just curious if you could just explain a little bit more why Oregon Association of Realtors chose to leave LLCs out of this bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, our intention was that this was going to be a placeholder bill and that the coalition bill was going to move first. And we're certainly willing to have the broader conversation about LLCs. I want to make sure on behalf of OAR that something gets done this session. This is a critical issue, especially for rural Oregon, as far as seller financing being available. And so I look forward to the broader conversation on LLCs and how we might structure something that insurers, and I think some of you are familiar with the issues that we've had with a particular company who creates an LLC for every single property that they own and avoid real estate licensing and a number of other issues. I think that could very easily be flagged, too, where you have an investor who sets up multiple LLCs, basically is in the loan business and the real estate business, and is avoiding licensure in all regards. I think there's a way to draft language so that you eliminate that, but at the same time, I don't think we really wanted to open that up.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. I appreciate your comments on the bill. It's been informative, and I think we're going to call up DCBS next if they're willing to come up and...
That's what they get for being here.
I asked them to be here. I know you were hoping there would probably be somebody else here to testify today, but I'm thankful that you're here. Good afternoon, gentlemen. If you introduce yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brian Light. I'm the Deputy Administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. Administrator Tapman does apologize that he can't be here today, but he's down the hall testifying on our budget. So with me is Richard Blackwell, our Senior Policy Analyst and Legislative Coordinator, and we're here to answer any questions you may have.
Representative Vega Peterson, do you remember your question?
I don't remember my question. Thank you. So thanks so much. So what I'm just curious to get a sense of, you know, what this bill would be relieving people of by removing the require for licensure. So what can you tell me a little bit about what happens when somebody goes through the licensing process?
Chair Holvey and Representative Vega Peterson, the SAFE Act is fundamentally an individual licensing requirement, and so we are licensing flesh and blood folks to negotiate the terms of a residential mortgage loan. And part of that is that they haven't had a revocation in other states, that they've not committed any felonies or misdemeanors that would involve fraud or dishonesty. So as part of that, they have to be fingerprinted, which is difficult for an LLC to be fingerprinted, I would say. There's a financial history piece, so no bankruptcies, no histories of charge-offs, things like that. So they have to go through some pre-licensure education, so certain number of hours on federal law, state law, so lending law, basically. They have to get an identification number from the National Mortgage Licensing System, which is basically the state, or it's a national database that all 50 states use to license these folks.
And Rick, if you could identify yourself.
I'm sorry. My name is Rick Blackwell. I'm a senior policy analyst with the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. I was just so enthusiastic that
I hated to stop you. You were on a roll.
No, thank you, Chair. And finally, they have to be covered by a surety bond. And the bond is covered, well, the bond is picked up by their employer. And so it's weighted to the volume of the loans that the employer completes in a certain period. So those are the licensing requirements for anyone in all 50 states for under SAFE Act.
Thank you.
Other questions for DCBS?
So the question, Chair, that I have, so currently everybody's required to have the license to go through that procedure you've talked about to originate a loan.
Chair Holvey, Representative Lively, that's true.
That's true. One time only?
Representative Holvey, Chair Holvey, Representative Lively, it's renewed on an annual basis.
Okay.
Can I ask?
So, Representative Kinnegar.
Thank you. And what is the cost for the license?
Well, Chair Holvey, Representative Kinnegar, we can follow up with you on that, but I believe it's $100 per individual.
It is in that ballpark, but I don't have the exact figure. We can get it for you.
Thank you. And I would guess that, you know, being licensed, there is a pretty big regimen of reporting requirements and oversight that comes with that license as well.
Chair Holvey, that's correct.
Other questions before I launch into another one? thanks. I'm curious. You know, we've had this discussion about, you know, the CFPB has come out with this rule that Mr. Jillians was referring us to, where they've suggested three or fewer properties in a 12-month period for a seller-owned or financed property. So I guess my question is you know, going down the road of LLCs or going down the road of other types of entities that might do this same thing. I would imagine an LLC is a limited liability company, so that would infer they're doing it as a business, perhaps. I don't know. But so do you see this proposal as being strictly aimed at individuals who own property and then carry paper when they sell it?
Chair Hovey, yes. Our take on this, as we've been working with Mr. Jillians and stakeholders, is that this would be limited to individuals, flesh and blood individuals. In terms of the CFPB, I think they've really up to this point been rather silent on the interpretation of habitually or repeatedly. That could mean a variety of things, and states are actually grappling with that right now. And we know of about 10 states who have passed similar legislation, and in essence, they have fallen around this figure of 3 to 5, somewhere in that ballpark. But the CFPB itself has so far been fairly quiet.
So a question about the term of habitual, I guess. So if you did 3 to 5 every year for a period of 5 years, 10 years. I mean, at what point does that cross the line into being a business, or would you see that as still a seller-owned financed if this bill were to pass?
Chair Hovey, that's an excellent question, and that's the policy question that we struggle with. I think in essence, in working with the stakeholders on this bill right now, where we've landed on the 3 per 12-month period is a good place to be. Whether or not the CFPB would agree with that, I don't know. But in our working together, that's what we've come up with in terms of a comfort level.
And if I may add, Chair Holby, the other states that have tackled this issue have interpreted HUD's and now CFPB's definition of habitual to mean 3 to 5 transactions in a 12-month period. So the other states that have taken this on, and also some other states do carve out estates and trusts specifically. Whether a trust is a natural person, I don't want to get into here, but they have addressed that issue as well.
So are you aware if any of them have addressed LLCs in this?
Chair Holden, not to my knowledge.
And Representative Thatcher.
I just want to throw out there that just because there is an LLC involved in a property, a lot of family farms will put the name of their farm in an LLC, and it just kind of clarifies the division of ownership, whether you own 5%, you own 20%, it just kind of helps in that regard and in other regards. And these are, I would bet, most of the time individuals. I don't think they're corporations that are members of the LLC, but in that case, yeah, it would be hard to fingerprint a corporation, but the individuals who are the members of the LLCs are individuals that are members of the LLCs, and just because somebody has an LLC or property in an LLC doesn't mean they're in the real estate business or in the business of selling and all that stuff. There are other reasons to have an LLC. So,
granted, and I agree, there are a lot of reasons, but I would guess an LLC could also have 10 members, and if you had 10 members and each of them were doing 3 a year, your LLC is now up to 30. And at that point, a year, I suppose that might be possible. I don't know if they would interpret that LLC as an individual, or each individual would have 3 that's within an LLC.
Chair Hull, Representative Thatcher, I think the LLC issue is one that needs some further discussion and working out.
Okay. The final question I have, it would concern real estate brokers, and in as much as they're individuals, they're in the real estate business, would they be able to do as an individual 3 per year as well?
Chair Holby and members of the committee, real estate brokers are exempt under the 2009 law for their own activities. I suppose if they were also in the seller carryback transaction, that would be the case.
So they're exempt from the loan originating license?
Chair Holby, that's correct, as long as they're acting under the scope of their license. So.
Okay, thank you.
other questions?
I just have a comment, Mr. Chair. The scenario came up with, if LLC had 10 members and you can have three, man, wouldn't that be a great problem to have if we had 10 members of an LLC that all had the ability to finance at least three seller-owned properties within a year? I mean, I think... Wow, I mean, if that becomes
a
problem,
deal,
across
huh?
the, you know, let's cross the bridge, we get to that, but I think that'd be terrific to get to that point. So.
Well, I could imagine Sean Jillians and a few others could definitely have that organized in a short time.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Richardson.
Just one thought on this. You know, we're talking about individuals that have money that are loaning it out,
mm-hmm.
and yet we're acting as if these are individuals who are gathering money from mom and pop and orphans and widows to put together like a security, and then we're going to, you know, and they may or may not wound these people or pay them their interest.
No, I don't think that's where we're headed.
Well, I understand that, but I'm saying that we're talking about regulating, and I know Dodd-Frank has come in and said everybody, but if a person has money and they want to loan it and they're not doing it as a regular basis, say if it's 3 to 5, maybe we ought to be saying, you know what, let's go to 5 and then we can rein it in, rather than making it as little as possible, but still allowing people that sell their home on a land sale contract, to be able to do that.
Yeah, and that's why we're having this discussion is to try to identify the right area that we can come down on a policy or hopefully agree on one to do this, because I think it is something we need to address. But at the same time, I think we're required to license loan originators as well. So, you know, following that law, and that's a, you know, a consumer protection issue as well. So,
Mr. Chair, that's a perfect summary of where we're at.
Thanks. No other comments. Appreciate you coming up and answering some of the good questions and some of mine. So, with that, no one else is needing to testify on this bill, I will close House Bill 2856, the public hearing on that bill. And Bob, I don't believe we have anything else on our agenda.
Good.
I will adjourn the House Consumer Protection Government Efficiency Committee.